if I could have the entire letter to look at, or at least enough of it so that I could put this last page in context.
Yeah, Scott.
Okay.
It's mostly full of technical data.
Well, I can skip that part. I get the impression here, though, in reading this, that these people down in Arizona were asked to participate in some kind of an outdoor project here in Oregon, to experiment with this device, and they said that they couldn't do it.
I have in front of me, Senator, about a 30-page response from this manufacturer to our request for proposal that we develop, and it addresses the conditions under which this device would be operating. And you're welcome to read this over, and they describe in depth what their equipment will do. As far as the problem that the hypothetical problem that you've posed, that would quite easily be handled because each of these devices would be available to ensure its proper operation when a climber checked out and left Timberline Lodge. I wouldn't want to go up there, you hand me a black box, and I can't tell if it's working or not. I would want to know that, in fact, it was working before I went up there, and our distribution system would ensure that not only would be working when the climber checked it out from a distributor, but at the wilderness boundary or point of departure, in this case, Timberline Lodge, we would, at this point, are anticipating having a detector that the person could verify it was operating. The problem that the manufacturer is very much concerned about is the beer bottle incident that you described occurring up on the mountain, which is certainly out of the manufacturer's control and certainly out of our control.
I know what this, Senator Wires was talking about the amendment here, which would include anybody up on the mountain who gave this device to somebody else, is not confined just to the manufacturer. See? So I think here's the concern I sense that some of us are kind of wrestling with here. And I think that you all would agree with this principle that we have a situation that we want to try and correct. An incident that we don't want to be repeated, but we, at the same time, we don't want to put into the hands of our mountain climbers, particularly the young people like we're on this particular trip, any kind of device or anything else that was likely to be to have even fatal results without some assurance that that device at least had been tested in accordance with some standards or manufactured in accordance with some standards. We don't want to jeopardize the young climbers by giving them a false sense of security by saying, here, take this out, you know, and it's going to be a surefire thing. We want to make sure at least that these are safe for these people, don't we? We'd all agree on that.
I agree with that concept, and this letter will explain to you how thoroughly they do test their equipment. The consequences of this thing not working gets us right back to the way mountain climbing is today and has been since people have climbed mountains. If it fails, you're in the same situation that you are today. It is not making your situation any more dangerous. And if there's a reason that this device should not be used, it would be specifically that false sense of security that you described.
Yeah, that's the real bad part of it.
And we do not encourage that concept at all. Quite simply, with this device, your chances of being located are increased hundreds, if not thousands, of times over. Without it, you're in the same situation that you would be today if you decided to climb the mountain.
That's precisely true if this works. And that's, you know, that's the area that we're struggling with now. How can we assure that when someone takes these out, they're likely to work? That's what I'm hoping that we, you know, can pin down here. Make sure that if we're going to eliminate liability for the manufacturer or the producer of these devices, that at least we've taken all reasonable steps to assure mountain climbers in Oregon that they've got a reasonable basis of expectation, you know, some kind of a right to rely on this thing. And I think that's what we all want.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Perhaps I can help. resolve this with suggesting some language. Part of what was discussed a few minutes ago, you might correct just by adding at the very end the words "resulting from the use of such device." In other words, then it would say, no person may maintain an action for injury incurred during wilderness travel or mountain climbing resulting from the use of such device. And then you could go still farther if you want to and say, unless the failure of the device was due to an intentional act on the part of the user, or something like that. I'm sure that your committee counsel could add an exemption for malicious intent.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm sure counsel may be in touch with you on that, Judge, and I think we're kind of agreed now that we've pointed out some of the potential pitfalls in the present language, that what we want to do is make sure we've got the right words here, so sure, these things won't happen. Yes, Senator Brenneman.
Just for a point of clarification for me, the big problem is in this device or these devices you're looking at is that none of them are manufactured for mountaineering. They're used for other purposes.
That is correct.
And are there suitable tracking devices for mountaineering currently available?
To our knowledge, from our inquiries throughout the mountain climbing community, not only in this country, but in several of the countries that we've sent inquiries to, no such device exists for this purpose.
Okay.
Perhaps it should be amplified. There are devices that serve a somewhat similar function, but in a different way. They have plates that you can put on your boots, which serve as a radar reflector, but they're a very short range and don't do what this device does.
One more.
Go ahead, sir.
About these devices that are used by pilots that emit a beep when you go down, that's not a practical situation to use those.
That's quite similar to this device. One of the big problems with that device is they currently have a 97% false alarm rate. That's quite distressing to our search and rescue folks. Also, the frequency that they use is closed only to the use by FAA and Coast Guard. They have other problems, too, in their physical size as far as being used on the mountains, but it's a very similar type of system to what we propose.
All right, Senator Hamby.
And there is no unit of government like the Coast Guard or some such unit that is currently testing this device that we can. I share the chair's concern about, you know, including every single manufacturer of every tracking device. Is there some way that we could somehow narrow the scope? Something hasn't been tested by the Coast Guard. Has it been tested at all, other than, you know, FCC?
The testing of this particular device has been carried out in the field for 20 some years. This particular company has the bulk of the research community's business because of their reliability. But as far as a specific test to do what we propose to do, I am not aware of that being done outside of our committee, which I might add is composed of lots of people in the electrical field.
And you feel strongly that we need to include manufacturer, distributor, seller, and supplier, all of them, rather than just simply the manufacturer?
Well, I'm not an attorney, and I can't speak exactly to everybody's exposure in that area, but I am very concerned about all people concerned with this, in that they participate in the program as the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund members themselves.
Judge or
Senator Hamby, I think perhaps the answer to that is that it would depend on the manner in which it is actually put into use, and as was said earlier, the exact method of distribution hasn't been settled upon, but conceivably they could be rented out by a mountain equipment like REI or G.I. Joe's You can rent an ice axe or crampons or a sleeping bag or whatever. Maybe they would install these and rent them out, but they wouldn't want to do so unless they had some assurance that somebody's not going to come back on them if the gadget doesn't happen to work under the emergency conditions of a mountain search. So we feel it is necessary to include the supplier. Now, whether it was a commercial store such as that or an organization such as the Mazamas or the Boy Scouts or the Episcopal School, whatever, they should not be exposed to a risk that would induce them not to use the device. And that's the key to the whole thing. Unless we can somehow alleviate the risk, we're not going to get the use of the device at all, and then we're right back where we started.
Senator Hill.
In cases, is there any case law on other similar devices? And if I missed that part of discussion...
I have previously submitted a memorandum to the chairman. I'll make more copies available if the committee wants them. I did some research on this for the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund. There's nothing that is exactly the same, but there are some similarities. For example, smoke detectors in a house. There have been cases where a person has sued the manufacturer of a smoke detector saying it didn't work, therefore I lost my house or I lost it more than I would have. There have been such cases. There's a lot of automobile cases saying that...
Have they prevailed? Have the plaintiffs prevailed in those cases?
It can go either way. They can make a jury question on it. In some of the automobile cases, for example, the manufacturer has been sued saying that the design of the car was such that while it didn't cause the accident, it made the damage worse. For example, a door flies open or a seat belt doesn't hold or something like that. And the aggravation of the damages has been the basis for some recovery. So the manufacturer's concern here is not entirely imaginary.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add on to that, the theory has been strict liability, so an exemption from negligence does not help.
Of course, this bill goes way beyond trying to protect against the doctrine of strict liability.
I understand that.
Yeah. Senator Hill, go ahead.
They're actually rescue devices, though. I'm trying to focus this narrowly. There are devices that I, when people are shipwrecked and those kinds of things. I mean, do you have any cases that deal with those situations?
I have not found any cases. There are cases of signal buoys that didn't work. But then the action is against the government and they're under the Tort Claims Act, which involves considerations that we don't have here. I have not found any case precisely in point on this.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further questions by committee members? Council.
Can you describe how this device gets turned on? Is it always on from the time it leaves the plant? Is it turned on by the person who supplies it? Is it turned on by the climber when they get in trouble? How does it get activated?
Senator, this particular device would be activated by the climber when he feels that he is in a situation where he needs somebody to find him. The frequency would not be monitored on a 24-hour basis, but would, in fact, be monitored when a rescue is called out.
So you'd have climbers going through the same procedure they're going through now of registering.
Correct.
And letting people know they're on the mountain.
That's
and
correct.
And then when they don't return by a projected time, if they had checked one of these things out, the receiver would be hauled out and they'd see if they could find them.
That's correct, in addition to the normal activation of a rescue.
Is it conceivable that somebody could be in a situation where they could be harmed so quickly that they would not have a chance to turn on the device?
That situation could occur, and I didn't add it into, or it was not in this testimony, but we have such an additional device attached to this. It's extremely lightweight. It's extremely inexpensive in as a comparison, but its disadvantage is it's a close-range device designed for avalanche use. There's no turning it on. There's no turning it off. It's always on. The problem with that device is, again, the distance in which it transmits over. But we do intend to incorporate that with this device to cover that precise situation.
If I might add to that, the theory of using this radio device is that there will be more than one of them in the party. hopefully at least two, but maybe more. But if a person falls in a crevasse and it happens so quick he can't pull the plug or whatever is necessary to turn it on, somebody else in the party could do so.
Now, just so we've got the record perfectly clear, Judge Kester, at the present time, if you could go out and buy these devices, you could go ahead with the FCC approval, I understand, and provide them to the mountain climbers.
If you could get them. I guess the answer is a practical one. They just aren't available unless we can give the manufacturer this kind of protection.
Well, at least that's true with one manufacturer. But, I mean, I heard from earlier testimony that there's you've got one here, somebody else has got one down on the coast, and somebody else got one here and there, and their manufacturers in, where did I hear, Illinois? And where?
New Zealand.
New Zealand. But anyway, that at least... Assuming you could get the things, I guess you could use them, couldn't you?
I know of no legal prohibition against it, except the possible effects of the product's liability statute.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Thanks. Yes. Senator Hill.
The one analogy that seems to come to mind for me is that there are a lot of people who do skydiving, and obviously the parachute, I mean, it's even more immediate than I think than what your situation is, because if it doesn't open or if it's flawed, I mean, you really do stand a chance of death of it. Do parachute makers have something like this? I mean, where they're exempt? They've obviously got to do it right. I mean, you can investigate it to see if the chute was flawed in some way. And
if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, the problem is that this is a really unique device used for a very small number of people. And it's just not. Parachutes can be used by lots of. You know, they're used by a lot of people around, and there are a lot of people who make them. There's only one person that makes this particular device. It's good enough to meet the standards of this club, and they've checked through everybody in the world that makes anything like this. There's one device that they want to use here. There's only one that's good enough. There are, you know, a couple thousand people that climb Mount Hood a year. On a weekend, there may be five or six parties going up. If each one of those parties has two or three devices, you're talking about a very small number of devices to be made. There's no way that they can make these just for climbers. The way they make these is for animals and for other kinds of use. So the problem is that there's no incentive for them to sell these to climbers. They get nothing back for it. The small amount they sell, they can't sell enough to purchase liability insurance. So it's just a flat question of either we have them or we don't have them. Either we pass a bill that exempts them from liability or we don't have them. That's the bottom line.
If I could add a word, Senator Hill, perhaps an answer to the parachute question is this. If the parachute fails, that is the cause of the accident. If this thing fails, it doesn't make the climber in any worse position than he would have been without it, because this doesn't cause the accident which made the rescue necessary. This is something that comes later to help eliminate the effects of the accident which has already happened. It's not like a wheel coming off a car where that is the cause of the injury.
I understand what you're saying, sir. I guess it's just that you have, in fact, the causal connection in a way, I don't know, to me makes the argument stronger. I mean, you know that if a person with a parachute, if the parachute fails, I mean, they're going to be held liable. And they know that, and apparently they're willing to assume the risk of that and make their product well. But I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, we don't have any. We're just going to have to move along. Okay. I'm afraid, gentlemen. I appreciate very much the your willingness to kind of exchange, give us this exchange here. But you can see right away that there are questions by committee members about the breadth of this proposal. Okay, let's see. Now we have one more witness signed up, and that's the Sheriff Bill Brooks. Is he here, Sheriff? Yeah, do you want to come up and kind of, and then in the meantime, I think I would ask, if you don't mind, Mr. Russell?
Yes.
If you don't mind, would you give the page? I think I would like to see the letter that you've been referring to. And if you don't mind, why, we'll have the page run off a copy of it. All right, Sheriff, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I realize you're under a time constraint, so I'll be brief. A couple of things. It's my understanding that Mount Hood is the second most climbed mountain in the world. Mount Fuji is number one. They get about 12,000 climbers a year on Mount Hood. The reason I'm here today is that I believe that some exceptional legislation is needed simply to abolish the tort liability with respect to the mountain signal communication locator and the beacon and the related equipment. What we've heard today is that the technology is here, and this is a can-do way of providing a life safety factor to those who might otherwise perish without it. In other words, to give the climber the edge, but not like the parachute, which might be the proximate cause of the problem. We've heard some hypothetic horror stories here today about opening beer cans or pounding these things with beer bottles, but I suggest with the distinguished experts that we have assembled in this room, we could probably tell a hypothetical success story, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10 for every horror story, but that isn't leading us to what we really need to do, and that is to see the Oregon legislature take some bold leadership to make sure that the Good Samaritans do not face the undeserved trauma of defending oneself for product liability or the liability in connection with the acquisition, supply, distribution, use, or failure of the signal equipment to perform, and this performance under sometimes very extraordinary circumstances. The bottom line is, would we be better off with it or without it? And I think that is the question to which you would have the remedy. Thank you very much, sir.
I don't have any problem with the Good Samaritans. I am wondering, and I think other people are wondering, about the manufacturer. The Good Samaritans ought to be protected. They don't. They didn't make this thing. They didn't beat on with beer bottles, and they're probably acting in good faith. But if the manufacturer, through extreme lack of care, put something in the hands of the Good Samaritan that the Good Samaritan and the mountain climber relied upon, I don't know if we ought to really go that far. So I think what we're going to try to do is figure out if there's a way to protect the Good Samaritan, but not say at the same time to every manufacturer in the country, you're invited to send defective products into Oregon because you got, immunity.
Maybe I should have been more specific in referring to the Good Samaritans as our mountain signal people, who are very concerned.
I think you're right on that, Sheriff. Any questions, Sheriff?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Brennan.
A lot of statements being made, I guess, at this point. I'd say I'm perfectly comfortable with the CAFORI amendments that are presented to us today, and share the other committee members' feelings maybe in some regards.
Any questions of the witness? Okay, Sheriff, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 915. Now let me just take a minute here and see what I can do to... There are a lot of folks back here, and we're not going to get to all these bills, and I don't want you to wait here the rest of the evening and be disappointed. So if you'll just be patient, I'll try to figure out what bills we'll be able to hear. Okay, we're going to... All right, we're going to do... we're going to do Senate Bill 1016. Oh, wait a minute now. Yes, all right, we'll do Senate Bill 1016, then we'll do Senate Bill 154, and my guess is that that's probably all we're going to get to today. I know that there are some members of this committee that have another legislative matter on today's agenda, so they're going to have to leave here at 5. Do you think those two bills are going to take 25 minutes?
Citizens arrest on enemy professional.
Well, let's see the sign up list on those two. That is 154. Oh my God.
154.
154 and 10.
All right.
Oh, all right. Short, Mike.
Well, why don't you let that witness testify?
What did Kester used to be a judge on?
Yeah.
Lady. Union Pacific's general counsel. Got a brain. Tell you what, let's take
5 minutes.
We got. I'm looking at the Senate bill. I'm still trying to get this figured out so I can accommodate as many people, especially those from out of town, as possible. Senate Bill 1016. Is Mr. Lawrence still here? All right. Now. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go to Senate Bill 793 because, among other persons, there's someone from California, and I know it's not going to be too convenient to come back from California. So we're going to go to Senate Bill 793, and then I don't see anybody on Senate Bill 154 that is from out of town. I could be wrong. Anybody on 154 from out of town? Well, okay, Ruth, I see you. You should have put your address on here.
She says she's from California.
Okay. Well, all right. We'll do the best we can here on these things. Anyway, I'm going to say to the rest of you now that we're not going to, outside of those bills, 793, 154, and 1016, we're not going to get anywhere else. So if you're here on any other bill, we'll just have to reschedule it. Now, on Senate Bill 793, is it Margie Sherman and Charles Ferber together on this?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
we'll
good.
We'll try and speed things up that way.
Good.
I appreciate your indulgence.
Yes, thank you very much.
We'll wait just a minute till we get the mob quiet out there. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Margie Sherman. I'm here today on behalf of Old Republic Surety Company and Western Surety Company, the requesters of Senate Bill 793, and with me is Mr. Chuck Ferber from the National Notary Association. Senate Bill 793 is a reinstatement of the bond requirement for notaries public. The bond was on the statutes since 1854. It was repealed in 1983 along with the oath. We believe that the public should be protected by mistakes or willful negligence on behalf of notaries. I have given you copies of several documents. I won't go through my complete testimony. Seven other states have now instituted the $10,000 bond requirement. Those include Washington, California, Idaho, and Nevada. The Model Notary Act has within its requirements the $10,000 bond and has been endorsed by the National Association of Secretaries of State. In your packet is an article from the Oregonian which relays a case where a son forged signatures on a second mortgage and tried to sell his father's house out from under him. Luckily, the title company secretary caught the discrepancy and the gentleman was saved from losing his home. Acts of forgery are typically the most misrepresentation of person is the most likely problem with notaries. I have put in your packet information of claims from other states. We can't document to you how many claims would have been filed in the last 4 years because obviously there haven't been. We haven't had a bond. Prior to that time, the bond was $500, and consumers and particularly attorneys were not willing to go to the time and effort and expense to file a claim on such a nominal amount. Oregon has always prided itself on consumer legislation, and this is another piece of it, and I appreciate your support. I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Ferber so he can get back on an airplane to California. Thank you.
Yes, and I appreciate your courtesy very much. My name again is Chuck Ferber. I'm the Vice President of the National